Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us here at KMXT 100.1 FM. It's time for the new news. The Kodiak Emergency Operations Center has received new COVID-19 case information for the Kodiak Island Borough. One new case has been reported. This case was a close contact of a previously reported case, bringing the total case count to 1,046, with 17 cases classified as active locally. There are no new active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. For the weather, 33 degrees Fahrenheit at present. Today, a 20% chance of snow before 3 p.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 39. A west wind of 5 to 15 miles per hour, increasing to 15 to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. Winds could gust as high as 30 miles per hour. For tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 31, a west wind of 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts as high as 35 miles per hour. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 38, west wind of 10 to 15 miles per hour.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. launches into a new year with anemic job growth. The Labor Department's monthly employment report out today shows the economy gained just 49,000 jobs in January. The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the federal government will be releasing new guidance next week about reopening schools. NPR's Aisha Roscoe reports President Biden has made reopening schools a priority, but concerns have been raised about safety.
The administration's goal is to get children back into classrooms even before the pandemic is over. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says further guidelines for making that happen are in the works.
We are actively working on the guidance, the official guidance, which will be released in the week ahead.
Earlier this week, Walensky had said getting teachers vaccinated is not a prerequisite for opening schools safely. But the White House downplayed that statement, saying Walensky was speaking in a personal capacity. President Biden has set a goal of getting most elementary and middle school students back to in-person learning by the end of April. Aisha Roscoe, NPR News.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is speaking out a day after she was expelled from two powerful committee assignments.
When the Democrats and 11 of my Republican colleagues decided to strip me of my committee assignments, Education and Labor and the Budget Committee, you know what they did? They actually stripped my district of their voice.
Critics from both sides of the aisle rebuke Green for her public support of far-right conspiracy theories like those calling mass shootings at schools staged and her history of violent rhetoric against Democratic leaders. The European Union is condemning Russia's decision to expel three European diplomats, accusing them of attending rallies in support of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports the Kremlin announced the move while the EU's foreign policy chief was visiting Moscow.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, says he found out Russia was declaring envoys from Germany, Poland, and Sweden, persona non grata, while he was meeting Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Borrell says he rejects allegations the three had conducted activities incompatible with their status as foreign diplomats. The Russian government says they attended a January 23rd protest. The decision should be reconsidered, Borrell says. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called the expulsions unjustified. Both Poland and Sweden said their diplomats had only carried out their official duties. Poland says if the decision is not reversed, it may retaliate against Moscow. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The U.S. trade deficit's the largest it's been since the height of the 2008 financial crisis. Commerce Department reporting pandemic-related disruptions resulted in a trade gap ballooning more than 17.5%. to nearly $679 billion last year. You're listening to NPR News.
An MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crew medevaced an ailing man from a fishing vessel 41 miles northeast of Cold Bay Wednesday morning. Watch Sanders in the 17th District Command Center in Juneau received the medevac request for a man suffering acute symptoms of appendicitis aboard the fishing vessel Arica at 9:18 a.m. About a half hour later, a rescue swimmer was lowered to the vessel to assess the patient's condition and prepare him for hoist and rescue basket. The patient was placed in the care of Cold Bay EMS in stable condition. The helicopter crew was based out of Air Station Kodiak and was on deployment to forward operating location Cold Bay. It would probably seem at first that the COVID-19 pandemic would have a paralyzing effect on senior citizens of Kodiak, and that probably would be true for many senior centers around the country. but Senior Citizens of Kodiak has maintained an impressive amount of its program throughout the pandemic, albeit without the in-person gatherings. Pat Branson, Executive Director of Senior Citizens of Kodiak, says that some programs have in fact expanded.
So we have home-delivered meals, and how that has been affected by the pandemic is that it has increased more, it's more than doubled. So we are serving home-delivered meals to people who maybe should have been getting them before the pandemic set in, but are now getting them and are very receptive and grateful for them. So we have had to have two home-delivered meal routes because of the demand. And those meals are 7 days a week. Our congregate meals, of course, are not, that program is not happening, but we are providing curbside meals at the back door to people 60 and older, and that's been very popular. In fact, we have had people come and pick up meals, curbside meals, that have never come to the senior center to eat a meal. So we're delivering about 100 meals a day, and Monday through Friday, and then we deliver home-delivered meals on for the weekend as well.
But with that said, it's been a far cry from business as usual for Senior Citizens of Kodiak.
The adult day program we've revised a bit in that for a couple of months, we were able to do some one-on-one activities at the assisted living across the street, Sunrise Assisted Living, and then with a couple of our adult day participants coming one at a time to our program. We've also have, since we own the CATS buses and we're the grant financial administrator of the CATS and we contract with First Student for the CATS bus, we have had some drive-around buses with our adult day participants as well. And we've adapted to Zoom like every other program has in the country. And we have two exercise programs via Zoom, Monday and Friday. And then we're looking to pony up with the Anchorage Senior Center and do some green games as well. So we've also, we call people and have sent cards to people to maintain that contact so they know that we're still here. Of course, our newsletters keep going out, and our information referrals by phone have been much in demand.
Branson says that this has been a learning experience, and while the programming Senior Citizens of Kodiak had before the pandemic would be preferable to this, she's expecting that some of the changes will persist in a post-COVID world.
You know, we may continue curbside meals. I don't know, but it certainly might be a mix. What we have learn to adjust to providing during this pandemic and what we were doing previously before the pandemic. So that's what I would suspect. It would be a mix and to see what the best way is, the best ways are to deliver services to the people who need them. That's our mission.
Ultimately, Branson is pleased with how Senior Citizens of Kodiak has weathered the pandemic.
We have kept all of our employees on board, and we're very glad about that. Everyone's cross-trained, and it's really been needed in getting the number of meals out that we provide each day. We have a solid board, we have a solid staff, and we'll be here for a long time, and the number of people who are aging in place in Kodiak is, they're not leaving like they did 25 years ago. They're staying here and retiring, and it's a great place to be.
Those looking to learn more about Senior Citizens of Kodiak or contribute to their efforts can do so at kodiakseniorcenter.org. One of the National Science Foundation's flagship initiatives for the past few years is called Navigating the New Arctic. It looks at the effects of a warming climate on Arctic communities. However, some in the field believe NSF isn't doing enough to involve indigenous people who live there. More than 200 researchers from around the country signed an open letter to the foundation last month, requesting more indigenous input within the initiative. As Wesley Early with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, NSF officials say they're taking the critiques seriously.
Margaret Anamak Rudolph is a doctoral candidate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. An Inupiaq woman originally from Fairbanks, her area of study is cross-cultural science education.
How do we kind of improve basically working relationships between researchers and Indigenous communities?
Rudolph is also one of the people who authored the letter to the National Science Foundation. While she welcomes the foundation's initiative, she says it falls short of its potential to include the people who live in the Arctic.
NSF is still centering researchers in navigating the new Arctic instead of centering Indigenous people and kind of what they want and what they need.
The letter from researchers was formed in solidarity with another letter sent last year from four Native organizations: Kuwerik Incorporated, the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Bering Sea Elders Group, and the Aleut community of St. Paul Island. The letter from Native groups outlines several issues that would have been studied more comprehensively if traditional knowledge was included from the start. Those include food security and community infrastructure. It also highlighted problems with requests for proposals. Henry Huntington is an Eagle River-based independent researcher who's worked with the initiative. He's also one of the main authors of the open letter. He says that requests for research proposals from the National Science Foundation are geared to traditional academic knowledge.
The forms that you fill out work out pretty well if you have a bunch of university degrees and you have some scientific publications and all the standard things that you'd expect of someone with academic training.
Comparatively, Huntington says it's harder to list the traditional knowledge of Alaska Natives, who often are much more informed on their communities and will contribute as much, if not more, to the research.
They confirm what we already know instead of investigating what we want to know.
That's Kena Uluk Ichokiak, one of the more than 200 scientists who signed the letter. Ichokiak is a PhD candidate in technical communication and rhetoric at the University of Utah. An Inupiaq woman from Kotzebue in Norvik, she says growing up, researchers coming into her community would often form questions that Alaska Native people already knew the answers to.
And so it's taken tons of time for academia, right, and the scientists to catch up to us. They're just catching up.
Kuwerik Social Science Program Director Dr. Julie Raymond Yacobian helped write last year's letter. She says oftentimes when Arctic researchers are making research proposals, one of their last steps is to ask for collaboration with tribal organizations instead of including them from the start.
When tribes and tribal organizations and Alaska Native organizations are brought into the process so late in the game, there's really no way for us to effectively collaborate on a truly equitable level.
NSF Arctic Sciences Program Director Colleen Strawhacker says a major initial issue with navigating the new Arctic was that many researchers were eager to compete for grants and proposals, making tribal outreach a lower priority.
Given the feedback from communities, that's clearly it's quite frankly a disrespectful approach to kind of including Indigenous communities in NNA type science.
While NSF officials are still working on a formal response to the letter from the Arctic researchers, Strawhacker says she values the feedback. She says building and strengthening tribal relationships is key moving forward with navigating the new Arctic.
I think it's critical to, if we want to fund the best science in the Arctic, that we need those perspectives. We need perspectives from multiple scientific disciplines, but we need perspectives from Indigenous elders and the knowledge that they have acquired. And I think if we don't do that, then we are doing a disservice to the science and understanding the changes in the Arctic.
At the beginning of February, NSF announced that the Navigating the New Arctic Community offices would be hosted at three universities, including the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Alaska Pacific University, a tribal college in Anchorage. APU President Valerie Nadadaluk-Davidson, a Yupik woman, described the office as a, quote, hub for Indigenous engagement. Raymond Yacobian from Kuwerik says she's hopeful that outreach like this, the solidarity between Native groups and researchers shown by both letters, and a push for more Indigenous researchers will ensure Arctic science works for both the people writing the papers and the subjects of those papers. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Wesley Early in Kotzebue.
The federal government has hit pause on preparations for an oil lease sale in Cook Inlet, after President Joe Biden signed an order indefinitely halting new leases. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management was gearing up to solicit bids on 1 million acres in Cook Inlet's federal waters later this year, but Biden said January 27th his administration wants to review the federal leasing program, one part of a broader order geared at combating climate change. Before the lease sale stalled, a draft environment impact statement had already been released. The comment period for that impact statement and all February meetings are now canceled. Kara Moriarty is the president and CEO of Alaska Oil and Gas Association. She says it wasn't surprising that the Cook Inlet lease sale was paused after Biden's order.
What we don't know is this indicative of all lease sales into the future? I mean, we certainly would hope not.
Even without presidential intervention, it's not clear that the Federal Bureau would have held the lease sale. The agency canceled lease sales in 2006, 2008, and 2010 due to lack of industry interest. Hillcorp was the only bidder in state and federal lease sales in Cook Inlet for several years. Environmental groups say the moratorium is a good thing. Cook Inlet Keeper Advocacy Director Bob Shavelson says it's refreshing to see the new administration take action.
And there has been strong opposition over the decades to industrializing Lower Cook Inlet. And we've got strong commercial fishing and sport fishing and tourism and subsistence economies here that would directly conflict with heavy industry and oil and gas development. So it doesn't make sense to throw all that away so Hillcorp can make a few more dollars.
Even without widespread industry interest, it's important for Alaska that the opportunity is there, says Tim Dillon, executive director of the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District.
Our governor has said over and over again that, you know, here in Alaska, we do it the safest way possible. And people know that. And to just put a stop on everything really hurts an industry in a big, big way.
If the Biden administration does let leasing proceed, a new comment period will be opened. It's been 3 weeks since a fire destroyed Tuluksac's only source of drinking water. Since then, the village has been living on donations of bottled water. The donations have come from activists, a gold mining company, and even an indigenous rapper from the pop rap group The Black Eyed Peas. But noticeably absent have been supplies from the state government. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has more.
Governor Dunleavy has yet to declare a state-level disaster to address Tuluksac's water crisis. In doing so, he's holding back up to $1 million in disaster relief funding for the village. State legislators who represent Tuluksac say they're working on it. Senator Lyman Hoffman says he is looking at options that would pay for the long-term response to the crisis. But Representative Tiffany Zolkowski says that the House can't really do much in the short term and that the governor should declare a state disaster.
The sphere of influence related to the circumstances in the village of Tuluksac and its water crisis is most influenced by the administration and the executive branch's ability to move the disaster request forward within its own process.
She told me that she's contacted Governor Dunleavy's office multiple times in recent weeks, asking him to declare a disaster and to send in the National Guard.
So did the governor's office never contact you back?
I have not heard a response from the governor's office on my inquiries related to National Guard support, whether they've pursued unspent CARES funding that had been provided to the state, or anything related to the issue in Tuluksac.
I also contacted the governor's office. It put me in touch with the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, where spokesperson Jeremy Zedek said that although the division has not donated supplies, it can provide relief to Tuluksac without a disaster declaration.
In order to respond to emergencies in Alaska, we don't need a disaster declaration. We don't need a disaster declaration to provide water to folks.
I guess I'm just curious if the state had that capability to send water without any sort of disaster declaration. How come they didn't?
Well, one of the requests that we had from Tuluksac was that they didn't have access to fresh water. The request that we had from Tuluksac was that they didn't have access to potable water. So our primary concern was restoring that access.
Meaning that rather than giving Tuluksac fresh drinking water, They coordinated with private citizens and agencies to make sure that water bottles could be flown in or driven in. Zedek said that part of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services' job is to make sure that if the community can't respond to the emergency, someone else does, like nonprofits or private companies, but not necessarily the state itself. He said that a gubernatorial disaster declaration is more for a long-term approach to recovery, and the state government likely won't need to respond in the long term in this case, since the tribe has already filed a grant request for a permanent water plant and washateria with the Federal Indian Health Service.
Okay, so it's really not for a short-term response.
That's correct.
Zedek says his division is writing a report on the water crisis to send to the governor's disaster policy cabinet, after which the cabinet could recommend that the governor declare a disaster. The governor could then release up to $1 million in relief funds without legislative approval. Zedek didn't say when or if this would happen. In an email, Representative Zolkowski said, quote, "If any larger community in Alaska was without reliable access to water during a global public health crisis, it is almost certain a disaster would be declared," end quote. She also said that Alaskans who live in Tuluksak deserve just as much access to state emergency resources as Alaskans in other communities. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. COVID concerns push seafood sales to jaw-dropping levels. More after this.
Did you know that eating wild and sustainable Alaska seafood can boost your immune system? Learn more about Alaska seafood's many proven nutritional benefits at wildalaskaseafood.com.
Seafood sales are on fire across all categories, including online, and it's likely to continue. That's according to new data presented this week at the National Fisheries Institute's Global Marketing Conference and reported by Seafood Source News. In 2020, health concerns over the COVID pandemic pushed up U.S. frozen seafood sales by 35% to $7 billion. Fresh sales rose 24.5% to $6.7 billion, and shelf-stable products rose by 20.3%. to nearly $3 billion, and online seafood sales tripled to top $1 billion. IRI, a world leader in market data, said sales at in-store fresh seafood counters jumped 28% to $871 million. Salmon led all seafood in fresh sales, followed by crab and shrimp. Cod and halibut also made the top 10 list. Shrimp was hands down the big winner in the frozen category. Shelf-stable salmon sales soared 30.3% to $286 million. Despite the jaw-dropping numbers, market experts point to some red flags. Baby boomers were the biggest buyers of shelf-stable seafood, like canned, and there's a need to engage with younger consumers. Also, frozen seafood sales skewed towards wealthier households, pointing out a need to attract lower-income seafood buyers. IRI predicts growth in all seafood categories will continue this year. Online seafood sales are likely to experience double-digit growth in 2021. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
KMXT's Island Messenger, supported in part by the Kodiak Daily Mirror, your hometown newspaper since 1940. Now online at www.kodiakdailymirror.com.
Well, good afternoon. Today is Friday, the 5th of February of 2021. The sun rose today at 9:03 a.m. and it will set again at 5:46 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 8 a.m. or no, that's a 9 a.m. District tides, we had a high tide this morning at 7:26 a.m. of 8.73 feet. A low tide will occur again at 2:33 p.m. of 1.09 feet, a high tide at 8:53 p.m. of 5.42 feet, a low tide at 1:50 a.m. of 3.07 feet, a high tide at 8:34 a.m. of 8.79 feet. West side tides of Euganic Bay. We had a high tide this morning at 7:50 a.m. of 14.11 feet. We'll have a low tide again at 2:51 p.m. of 2.0 feet. A high tide will occur at 9:15 p.m. of 10.97 feet, then a low tide at 2:50 a.m. of 5 feet, and a high tide at 9 a.m. of 13.76 feet. For daylight, we had 8 hours and 43 minutes of daylight today. It's going up, a gain of 4 minutes and 35 seconds. The record high for today was 49 degrees in 1957. The record low in 1943 and 1999 was 0 degrees. I was very pleased to have told you that there was snow outside as part of our 20% chance of snow before 3 p.m. prediction here from my weather information, but it has stopped snowing since then, so unfortunately it is not, well, I don't know, fortunately or unfortunately, it is not snowing. For today, mostly cloudy with a high near 39. A west wind of 5 to 15 miles per hour, increasing to 15 to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. Winds could gust as high as 30 miles per hour. For tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 31. A west wind of 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts as high as 35 miles per hour. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 38. A west wind of 10 to 15 miles per hour. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 26. West wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 37, a northwest wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour, and for Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 27, northwest wind around 5 miles per hour. For PSAs, the Kodiak City Council will hold a planning meeting on Saturday, February 6th of 2021. The meeting will begin at 9 a.m. Public participation for this meeting will be virtual for everyone's protection. There will be no public in-person attendance for this meeting in compliance with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance on social distancing and gathering. This meeting will be web-streamed, and the web streaming link and meeting packet are available online at https://cityofkodiak.civicweb.net/portal. For those who wish to request printed meeting materials or have questions regarding the meeting, please contact the clerk's office at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council will hold a work session on Tuesday, February 9th of 2021. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. This meeting will be held virtually for everyone's protection. There will be no in-person attendance for this meeting in compliance with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance on social distancing and gathering. Public members are encouraged to tune in to KMXT 100.1 FM. Meeting packets are available online at https://cityofkodiak.civicweb.net/portal/meeting-type-list.aspx. For those who wish to request printed meeting materials or have questions regarding the meeting, please contact the clerk's office at 486-8636. And the Kodiak City Council will hold a regular meeting on Thursday, February 11th of 2021. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. Public members are encouraged to tune in to KMXT 100.1 FM. The meeting will be held virtually for everyone's protection. There will be no in-person attendance. Meeting packets are available online at cityofkodiak.civicweb.net/portal/meeting-type-list.aspx. For those who wish to request printed meeting materials or have questions regarding the meeting, please contact the clerk's office at 486-8636.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
KMXT is supported in part by Orion's Mountain Sports, featuring equipment, clothing, and footwear for your outdoor lifestyle. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the February 5th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. What a refreshing bit of real winter this week. Cooler temps, clearer skies, some snow on the ground, and beautifully frosted plants and trees. My kind of winter. Although Saturday is supposed to be a bit breezy, Sunday should be a little calmer and sunny. A good day to go out and do a little bird watching in preparation for next weekend's Great Backyard Bird Count. The bird count starts on Thursday the 12th and goes through Monday the 15th. All you have to do is watch and count birds for one 15-minute period during that weekend, record your findings, and you'll be part of a worldwide citizen science project. Pretty cool. If you have youngsters, this is a great way to introduce them to the world of birding and being observant in nature. And the best part? You don't have to go anywhere exotic to participate in the count. You can even do this from a window in your home. Take a little time this week to check out the website birdcount.org and sign up to participate. February is a great time to start watching the waterfront too. Not for birds, but for whales. Thursday morning, I glanced out and saw something that looked a little different in the distance. I watched for a few more minutes and saw a spout. I suspect it was a humpback. I didn't see a dorsal fin. Moral of the story? Keep your eyes open when along the shore. Don't forget that KMXT's online silent auction is going on this weekend. You can register at kmxt.org. And the Kodiak Maritime Museum has their annual meeting followed by some poetry and songs by Fisher poets. That all starts at 6:30 p.m. on Friday via live stream. You'll find a link on their website at kodiakmaritimemuseum.org. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.